So this summer on vacation, Michelle and I picked up this mug at the Novelty Bookstore Cafe in the town of Truro, Nova Scotia. Some of you can see that it says Rise and Shine in large letters with a yellow circle vaguely suggesting the sun around the markings. And the "and" is written in red, and it's underlined, and there's huge asterisks on either side to emphasize the "and." Rise and shine. And then there's a question mark at the end. And then in small letters at the bottom says, "That's kind of a lot to ask." Now, you could read in that a whining or indignant voice of the sleeper, you know, "Rise and shine," or it could be the compassionate, empathetic truth teller observing a wake-up call. That tone for "that's a lot to ask" is the one I imagine when I apply it to the UU principles we are beginning to study this month. Affirm and promote. Reverend Meg Barnhouse points out in our first reading that many of us shy away from the latter, that doing the work of promoting. We treat the affirmations as generalities bordering on meaningless, which makes it easy to ignore them or make fun of them. They don't seem so meaningless, though, she says, if you silently add the words "beginning in our homes and congregations" to each one, and then try to live that way. So let me just give you a specific examples of how the principle can ask a lot of us. Like many of you, I'm heartsick about how Central Americans are being treated at our southern border. And the principles, as read by Reverend Barnhouse, tell me to do something significant about that or focus my attention on how Mexicans are being treated in Addison County by our local farmers and Vermont State Police. Of course, I can and should educate myself about what is happening at the southern border. I can and do send money to groups on the ground like No More Deaths to help. And I spread the word about their work. But generally speaking, I would have to go to Central America or the southern border to impact lives directly, and thereby not give money, time, and effort to helping the migrants who are here all around us. Reverend Barnhouse is saying that far from being a meaningless generality, each of the principles is a lot to ask if we really seek to apply them close at hand. Now, some of you may have noted that the principles are framed as promises that we make as a congregation. They're not binding on us as individuals, if you read that language in the front of the book in which they're listed or in the wall hanging we have. And that's true. In theory, every UU is free to reject any of the principles, as they are to reject any religious creed that makes no sense to them about God, the sinfulness of humans, or what happens after we die. We are a creedless religion, and as individuals, you could say we are a principleless religion if you were being literal. But of course, that's misleading. As I said to you last week, our tradition dating back to the Puritan settlers of Massachusetts is that we are pledged to walk together in our search for truth and mutual support. And we wouldn't get far if we were deeply and broadly conflicted in our views about the values expressed in our congregational principles. So the truth is that when you are a congregant here, and especially if you become a member, you owe it to yourselves and each other to affirm and promote these principles. We have failed as a congregation if they are treated as no more than earnest words on our walls or at the front of the hymnal. Now, with that much at stake, it's a shame we aren't really dealing with just seven principles. Studies show that seven things are about the most that we can keep track of, which makes 19 a scary number. But if you really study the principles, you know, look at them with the care that you might utilize looking at a treasure map that fell into your possession, You can see that the authors and the General Assembly delegates who approved their work have enshrined at least 19 of these aspirations. The first principle, for example, lifts up both the inherent worth of every person and the dignity of every person, two principles in one. The so-called fourth principle, affirming the right of conscience and use of democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, is pregnant with four principles. Respect for the right of consciousness in our congregations, respect for the right of conscience in our wider society, respect for the democratic process in our congregations, respect for the democratic process in the wider society. As I read the principles, only the seventh principle about the interdependent web of existence is singular in its focus. It's the only principle of the seven that does not include the word and. And that's not the worst of it. Since our congregation's covenant to affirm and promote the 19 principles disguised as seven, these 19 aspirations become 38. So how does "we're the religion with no creed but 38 principles" sound to you as a marketing slogan? I like to be thorough, as those of you who know me well know, and so I researched whether either 19 or 38 had some great significance that I had overlooked that we at least might find worth claiming. Well, according to the Quran, 19 is the number of angels who serve Allah by tormenting sinners in hell. And the most spiritual use of 38 that I could find was the number of slots on a roulette wheel. So I'm guessing we can agree that we have no incentive to identify the principles with either 19 or 38. We might have a lot of reasons, though, to advertise them as seven. As I've said, there is the fact that that is the limit to what most of us can remember, according to an awful lot of research. There's also a lot of religious history to seven, and a lot of you will know some of it. Among you, there may be some religion majors from college who know all of it. The Hebrew Bible begins with the creation of the world in 7 days, which is still the basis for our week. It ends with sevens running wild in the book of Revelation, a fantastic sequence of dreams and battles in which one encounters seven churches, seven angels, seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven stars. Post-biblical Christianity created the concept of seven sins that could drive you into hell, the seven mortal sins, and seven opposing virtues. The Quran speaks of seven heavens and the great Muslim pilgrimage, the Hajj, that every Muslim is asked to do at least once in their life. The Hajj to Mecca has a number of rituals that involve seven stages to complete. The most famous involves walking seven times counterclockwise around the shrine that's in the middle of the great mosque in Mecca, the so-called House of Allah, the shrine, and that's Islam's most sacred site. In Hinduism, there are seven higher worlds and seven underworlds. In Buddhist legends, the Buddha stood immediately upon being born and took seven steps, symbolizing seven characteristics, starting with mindfulness, that are visible in a spiritually awakened person. Japan has the tradition of seven gods of good fortune, one of them arising from its native Shinto religion, and the others derived more than 1,000 years ago from Japanese contact with Hinduism. Seven is also considered a lucky number in many cultures. It is the most commonly chosen favorite number in psychological testing, and it is the first selection of most people when asked to choose a random number between 1 and 10. Now, I know Priscilla knows the reason for this, why psychologically, why mathematically we're drawn to 7, or if you don't, I have a great reading for you. But it's fairly lengthy, and I'll move on. In light of all this, though, I will say, it might seem boring or even disturbingly mainstream, maybe, that modern Unitarian Universalism has built its way of being around the number 7. You might say defensively that, well, having 19 principles disguised as 7 is a good sly way of trolling traditional religion. Or that we did it out of loyalty to Albert Einstein, who teaches in science that things should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. But the bottom line is that if 7 as a disguise for 19 or 38 is what we're doing, it doesn't help center our hearts and minds. So here's some heartfelt advice about how to make something of the principles that you might be able to live more happily with. I want you to, like you have a timeshare, I want you to grab yourself a mind share of the Sandwalk at Down House, that home of Charles and Emma Wedgwood Darwin. As the reading said, it was a sandy path that Darwin constructed, and it started right outside the garden gate behind his kitchen. And it had two pieces, and you could walk it either direction. He did it both ways. But one of the ways took you first on a ridge overlooking all of these open meadows, and then the other way you would be looping back through the wooded area, a lot of which was wooded with trees that he had planted, even though there was a bit of a forest to start with. Now, I first read about Darwin's Sandwalk in connection with research about how and why we think more effectively when we are walking. Now, I haven't been personally tested on this, but intuitively, I think that's true. I think that I think better when I'm walking. This research doesn't account for the fact that I think even better in a hot shower, but we don't have to get into that to get onto my point here. Darwin had the habit of beginning his walks by piling up those stone flints near the gate, and he flicked one off each time he completed a circuit. Now, who knows what got him started doing this, but as the reading suggested, he eventually told friends that this helped him think about whether he had a two-flint or a three-flint or a four-flint problem that he was working on. Now, I love this idea, and it got me thinking about how we might apply it to the seven principles. I can't be everywhere at once in the principles or even see the whole landscape. It's too intricate and big. But I can venture out into them every day and look to accomplish something with my time and effort that I can feel good about. I can go out among the principles looking for clarity, just simple clarity about where I might want to go next with you as a congregation, looking at how we can walk together into the future. Some days, the walk into the principles might be short and sweet. Some days, stormy weather will intervene, literally or metaphorically. Some days, I won't be at home in my heart and mind. The parallel would be those days that Darwin was forced to leave Down House and go to London or somewhere for work, which he hated to do. Anyway, if you're not at home in your heart and your mind, you might not be able to venture out into the principles at all. Those are the days when, at the very least, I find comfort and encouragement hearing about what those of you who've been out on the path have discovered. And maybe we can all do that for each other. Imagining the principles as a path through the living world reminds me that my experience of these principles is always being shaped by what I notice along the way. The words don't change, but what they mean to me does. Now, Darwin occasionally noticed seeing wildlife, like a fox out on the trail as he was walking. And maybe we should consider what foxes might look like as we walk together through, say, the free and responsible search for truth and meaning, or any of the other principles. I think that living poetry can erupt within these principles if we approach them the right way, and it might feel like a fox would look like out on the trail. I want to promote our impulse to see and share what we can do and learn from such experiences. If I have one point to make with you about the principles, it's what the principles remind us to notice is more important than treating them as an agenda. In closing, I want to mention Francis Darwin, one of Charles's 7 children who made it to adulthood. He and Emma had 10 children altogether. And Francis used to do experiments with his father on the attraction of plants to light, and he later became a well-known botanist. As a child, he often played with siblings and friends along the Sandwalk, in the woods, around the Sandwalk, and he recalled that every now and then, the children would sneak up and reset one of the flint stones on top of the pile that their father had flicked off. Darwin never let on whether he noticed this as he walked on, pondering the mysteries of nature or other concerns. He was also known to be a very good parent, a very involved parent. So it could be he noticed right away and was playing the game with his kids. It would be great to have natural markers like Darwin's flints that roughly monitor our progress as we move through the principles. And I think we need to think about what those might be. Maybe markers of shared joys and sorrows would work well. But life plays tricks on us, just like Francis played on his father. And we shouldn't get hung up on measuring progress as we walk together. If we always have more walking and discoveries to look forward to, we can smile at any confusion about how many laps we've completed. May it always be so. Blessed be and amen.